Welcome to the Go Health podcast. I am Gillian Strain, Chief Exec of Go Health, an organization with a mission to enable churches and individual Christians to be a healing presence in the world. And right now we are in the Healing History series, where we're exploring the impact of our past on our present with a range of expert voices so that we can go on a journey through our individual and collective lives to find healing and flourishing. And our expert voice today is the Reverend Dr. Dan Inman, who is presenter of Chichester Cathedral. Dan, welcome. It's lovely that you're joining us. How are you today?
I'm grand, Gillian. It's great to be with you on this podcast.
Yeah, no, it's nice to connect again. We studied together, didn't we? That's how we met.
We did, yes, at Theological College.
In Oxford.
Yes, some striking memories from some interesting lectures. I seem to remember we were on together, but yes.
Yeah, quite a few years ago, so many years. I can't quite remember and I can't do the math quickly.
No.
But so we're meeting here today and you are presenter of Chichester Cathedral. What is a presenter? What's your day-to-day look like these days, Dan?
Well, yes, a presenter is the primus cantor in medieval terms. So I'm the first singer in the cathedral's establishment. So I take a particular responsibility for liturgy and music in the cathedral's life. And so day-to-day existence is shaped by the offices, and in particular, I suppose, a presenter in leading evensong. And anything can range from pastoral care for the choir itself and its families, and I take my share in the pastoral care of the life of the cathedral. But I also have responsibility for thinking about art and exhibitions, and I also take care of adult education in the cathedral. So it's a varied job.
It's really varied, and you're part of a team doing education. And the singing bit, first cantor, because that's not, you know, job description in the sort of jobs listing. Is that right, top of the list? The singing is the main thing. So you have to have a good voice to do your job, is that right?
Yeah, there are presenters who don't sing. They're usually accompanied by other people who can. But no, music's always been a part of who I am. In fact, it's not a job I would have applied for, but I've sort of ended up doing because no one else could do it. But it's really sort of played to my vocation, actually, in ways which has been really delightful.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. You didn't train in music, but this is...
No. Yeah, I think I always thought I was the academic, you see. So I sort of pursued that line of things. And actually, since being at Chichester, which has this USP relation to modern art, that's sort of become a focus for my work. So art and music. And actually, you kind of realise that perhaps if I had chosen to do art rather than Latin as a 11-year-old, things might have been quite different. But it's been a gift, really, being here in that sense. I've discovered parts of myself I think I'd forgotten.
Wow. Which bits?
I think the creative side, and then actually, rather than being obsessed with historical analysis and writing books and endless articles, I get much more joy from singing and being creative and shaping the artistic life of a community, which has been really wonderful.
That's really powerful, because at college, you know, you were already Dr. Dan, I think, right? You were already finishing your PhD.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we all labeled each other. You were academic, but this sounds like being a place of real flourishing, that you've discovered other things about yourself.
Yeah, I think, and just letting down certain things. I think certain ideas I had about myself and narratives, which I felt I had to pursue for various reasons. I've just discovered real delight and freedom in discovering that these are the things which animate me. But also, I think when I've been teaching in relation to art or liturgy, where I've seen other people come alive. I think people responding to me finding my vocation afresh. And it's been a real, real gift.
Wow, it sounds like a real intertwining. Sorry, we're just going completely off piece, but this is a real intertwining of some kind of healing and vocation for yourself. Yeah. I mean, this is our big thing in the Guild. You know, we teach about the healing ministry, but actually we've all got a vocation to offer the healing love of Jesus, but find out who we are.
Definitely. And I had a sort of bit of a disaster, I suppose, a couple of years ago, various reasons, which don't need to go into on the podcast. But that turned everything upside down, I think, and felt immensely desolate at the time, but a bit like a landscape after a volcanic eruption, perhaps. It's amazing to see the kind of things which have grown up in the aftermath of it all, and part of that has been discovering listening for God afresh, and I think hopefully find a great sense of healing.
Yeah, that's a really powerful image, the flourishing after the destruction of an event, and actually what a story as well, that of resurrection and things changing even though when things go wrong in the past.
Liturgy is core to that, I think, because it's the way in which all the time, all our lives, we're trying to make sense of loss and grief and desolation in relation to the Eucharist, and that's week by week, but it's also the liturgical year and the importance of Holy Week and the Triduum in making sense of who we are and the mystery of the cross and the resurrection. And that's been a great privilege in the cathedral to be part of that in a very particular way. And that's been part of the healing for me. But hopefully, you can see that healing happening in people's lives as a presenter in the liturgy, and it's an enormous privilege.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into that. You're in Chichester Cathedral, an ancient place, a historic place. When people think of cathedrals, they often think of, beautiful buildings that took hundreds of years to make. You've got the choral tradition as well, very traditional. Also, cathedrals are places of civic moments and national moments. Why is a cathedral not just, like a moving museum? Because it's got all the history stuff is there. With it, what makes it different?
Yeah, I think that's for the first part of what you said about the civic role of a cathedral. They stand as enormous monuments. Across this part of West Sussex, the cathedral towers above the landscape, and it's a place in which people do come to offer an offload and a huge amount of whatever they're carrying, just because it's got that presence in the heart of the city. And the Queen died would be a good example of that, the way in which hundreds of people just felt drawn to this place, even though they would never come here to worship. But it was the place which kind of held the memory of a life which was the life of the nation, I suppose. And you could extend that out, I think, in relation to the cathedral, because without giving a guided tour of the place, it's amazing how you realise it is a place defined by trauma as well, as much as its beauty and its modern art and so on. But that whether it's multiple fires in the 12th century, you can still see the scorch marks in the stone, or the Reformation and the Civil War in particular, which was devastating for the cathedral, as so many of our cathedrals, the brass ripped up, but for one piece, which kind of tells the story of a single family in Chichester. It's always a very striking and moving encounter. Or the spire collapsing in 1861, and you can see the damage to the stone where Gilbert Scott has replaced the spire in the early 1860s. So it's a place which is whose story kind of is part of the whole nation's story and its own story of trauma and crisis, but also in relation to the building itself. So I think it's a place in which people can locate their own challenges and struggles.
Because it's had its own history of trauma, and maybe subconsciously, and of course it's historic, but also contemporary. I mean, we're recording today on the anniversary of the terrible bombing attack in Manchester, and I know that Manchester Cathedral is hosting something today. It's natural. I mean, you said there that people were just drawn for some reason the Queen's death here. What do you think that it's not just that they've read a history of the Chichester Cathedral and gone, oh, hang on a second. It's deeper than that. What do you think that's about?
I think, even in our supposedly post-Christian age, I think at a very deep level, we all reach out in those moments, because we have to, for bigger stories about who we are. And somehow, I suppose, the old building, which kind of contains the traces of those memories and those stories, which are probably deeper within us than we often care to admit, it has a kind of magnetic quality. People are just drawn to it and find a place to try and make sense of who they are. I often think about, I remember Neil McGregor talking about museums as places where we discover who we are. And I think cathedrals do that in a different way, because there is that sense of the transcendent deep within all of us and the longing for it, even if we've stopped believing in God. I think people still need a different kind of space from a museum when these things happen, and cathedrals and churches do that in a different way, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, one of the big differences between museums and churches or cathedrals is that in churches or cathedrals, we gather together in big groups called congregations at certain times and do stuff together.
Yeah, together. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the expression of shared grief, which you know, it's one thing watching it on the television, but actually people do need to be present together, even if they're in silence. And the power of that silence is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, our churches and cathedrals were very recently shut, the door shut during the pandemic. I mean, historically, I'm not a historian, but I understand that it's only happened once, one other time during one of the plagues, that St. Peter's in Rome was shut and we shut our doors. What did you notice when you were Chichester then, weren't you?
I was, and it's traumatic for everybody, but I do have this very particular memory of going back into the cathedral for the first time when we were allowed to, and just clergy at that point. And the nave had been entirely cleared, because if you remember, we felt that surfaces were problematic, so we just kind of, everything was kind of taken away, and you kind of saw this raw cathedral laid out before you in the summer light, and it was... it was very beautiful, but there was this strange, very powerful feeling of anger I felt, and with me just projecting anger onto the space. But I felt that the space itself was crying out, saying, "I was here. You know, why weren't you? You know, why weren't these doors open? Why did you shut the place just at the time when the building needed to do its work for people?" And I don't want to go into those political and pained arguments around all of that. I think we recognize we could have done different things differently there, but I think it goes back to that point about a building holding memory and its connection in time and space to the people around it, in ways which we don't fully understand. And I think that was traumatic for the building, if that makes sense. Sounds a bit kooky.
No, I don't think it sounds kooky. There's a lovely is it R.S. Thomas poem about the sort of poem? It's an image of a building, a church settling after everyone goes home after worship.
Right.
Do you know that? And they sort of, it makes a difference when human beings are in spaces. Something does change. Something is left behind. And just picking up before we look at sort of current areas of hurt and healing around the church, but looking at the role of when people come together in our cathedrals, not museums, and worship together, and the role of liturgy in this. I mean, liturgy within the Anglican tradition is the tradition of the church where we understand there's good stuff about God and our relationship with God in the liturgy. In your experience, have you seen times that the received liturgies of the church, when done, performed by people, have helped people in times of need, when they need healing? Or in answering some of the bigger questions around what we're going through as a country?
Yeah, I think probably to take it down to a personal level, I was thinking about someone I spoke to last week who described coming into the cathedral for an Ash Wednesday Eucharist, who had just lost some close friends and a close relative, and sort of came with an immense amount of pain and crying out for something, you know, and wanting to encounter God's faithfulness, or just to hear something, as they came to the Eucharist. And they described how as the chalice and the bread were brought to them, this extraordinary moment where their bracelet, which this one of their loved ones had given them, who'd just died, snapped in two places, and the various beads fell off it, and that they, you know, you can talk about the coincidences there, but it was the way in which the liturgy interacted with the personal pain the bracelet expressed that somehow, but that the power of the Eucharist to bring healing in that context, in the context of Ash Wednesday too, I suppose, and a particular reflection upon mortality and where we come from and where we go. And that was clearly a moment of which helped them move on meaningfully. That's very, it sounds like a sort of not miraculous moment, but I think she did describe it as miraculous for her. It was immensely full of rich and meaning. But I think that's happening all the time. And particularly, I suppose, at Evensong, you notice that it's one of those services where people do drift in and drift out. The importance of the nave in a cathedral where people can just slip in without being seen, or someone saying, who are you? Why are you here? Or can we put you on a rota? And you can see people just who just come and sit in silence, don't engage in terms of standing up or saying the liturgy, but they come again and again. You can see there's something happening there which can't happen elsewhere in a parish church very easily, I think.
Yes.
And that's really important for cathedrals, is those borderlands of faith, not least if they're cross or angry or can't bear to be with people for various reasons. There's a space for them to make sense of themselves.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So you're based at Chichester. Now, Chichester's had a difficult history with the George Bell case. I wonder, Dan, if you could sketch a summary of that case in a few sentences. I know it's a big ask, but just if people haven't heard of it or need reminded of it. And then I'd love to know if you can tell us how you coped with that. You wander around with a dog collar on. You're part of the community there. How did you cope with the George Bell case?
Yeah, well, it's a long story, which goes back to before I came here as a canon. But there was an allegation made about George Bell quite a long time ago, which wasn't dealt with properly at the time by the bishop at the time. And when the diocese was in the middle of the last decade, really attending to its very difficult past and cover-ups and burning of records and so on, about which we know quite a lot from the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse, that the complaint returned and the diocese reached a settlement with the complainant. There was no trial to be had. George Bell was long dead. Very famous Bishop of Chichester, and much revered in the diocese and more widely in the Church of England's history. And with that, his name sort of began to be erased from a whole variety of buildings, monuments. And this wasn't something which I think the complainants had asked for, but it was the response of institutions, something which has become more prevalent since, I suppose, and sort of what we call a sort of cancellation of a person. Mm-hmm. And that provoked an enormous outcry, I think, among people who felt that George Bell hadn't been able to speak his side of the case, and also that good history had not been undertaken. And this led to, this included the cathedral, which had its retreat house, George Bell House. We had to take down that was before my time, but the chapter at the time, in good conscience, I think, seeking to do the right thing, took down his name from that building. And various traumas there, and handling them appropriately. I think now the established feeling following the Carlisle Review was that the diocese rushed to judgment effectively without due process, and made apology for that. And the cathedral eventually, last year, renamed our retreat house George Bell House. Mm. Incredibly difficult. You know, the complainant is still alive, and presumably those memories for her are still still felt. But I think that goes into the very tricky area around contested history, really, and how do you do justice to all parties? And I think the church didn't do justice to George Bell actually in that process, and I think we are right to rename the retreat house. But it was immensely painful, and for everyone involved, I think. And I think that the healing process for that is some way moved along. I think apologies have been made where they need to be made, but there's a part of that which will always feel very unresolved. I think all of that was in the context of well-documented and evidenced abuse by others in the diocese, you know, not least Peter Ball as Bishop of Lewes, and then Bishop of Gloucester. That's the most celebrated, being totally wrong word, obviously, but being the most famous case. And of course, that was you know, the culture of anxiety is to right the wrongs and to bring these things into light and to seek justice for survivors was entirely appropriate. But, you know, whether that culture of anxiety that leads to always the best decisions, I think.
Yes, yeah. And looking at it sort of more widely within the church and abuse, how do we balance, I guess, what you're saying around having good process to protect those who are accused with protecting and caring for those who have been victims?
Do you mean in terms of the processes
I think they're intertwined, aren't they? The processes and the care for those who have been harmed in the past.
And I think increasingly, and actually it's something been very much from my mind, I suppose, here as a liturgist, how does liturgy assist in the process of healing? Because you can have there's a certain amount of justice and which is established through, of course, through the courts and compensation appropriately, that can sometimes feel very much as being something which is led by lawyers and insurance companies. It can be quite dehumanizing. And of course, many of the survivors have really underlined that experience of feeling quite dehumanized by the process and the church standing afar off in pastoral terms. How you offer pastoral care appropriately, I think, is of course very difficult. Some people don't want anywhere near a dog collar in that situation, and who determines what is right for those people and their needs? That's a task for the wider church, and of course it's been subject to much reflection and discussion in synod as well. But I do think there is probably a space in due course. I don't know whether now is the right time, but to think about liturgy. And what does reconciliation and restoration look like? I mean, that's extremely difficult, and I don't think there are really examples of that being done extremely well in this country, at least yet. Not that I've seen. I did spend some time at one point in Canada. I remember seeing a very moving encounter in the context of a liturgy amongst First Nations community, Indigenous Canadians, who had suffered a lot in a residential school. And there was a headmaster of a residential school who came and sought forgiveness from the Haida people in the context of a Eucharist, and a leader of the Haida people received his repentance and offered forgiveness in the context of the Eucharist itself, which it was remarkable, but of course it's not something you can force upon people. And I think we're a long way from that at the moment, the Church of England. But I wonder whether it's also about space as well, sacred space. Is there something to be said for a memorial of some kind, a place where people can not be thrust into a liturgy where they suddenly feel controlled by the church, perhaps, but somewhere where they can just be and offload? Yeah. And art can do that sometimes more effectively, or a space, a chapel set aside where people feel safe and can do that without the church trying to make them feel a particular way.
Mm. And you mentioned art there. Is there a particular art or project or scheme that you've done at the Chisholm that you've seen the power of art in a holy space to help people?
Well, after the pandemic, we did work with the Royal Society of Sculptors. They had worked together very carefully during the pandemic, and they wanted a space in which to express the solidarity which they had shared through the trauma of lockdown, some of which was extremely painful to watch. Some of the art expressing the agony of an individual, for instance, and quite disturbing for people in some ways, I think. But there was something also oddly healing about that, about allowing the cathedral, which had been shut during the pandemic, to allow it now to receive the pain of people. And people, I think, did respond to that negatively as well as positively. But I think it, you know, forced people, when they were trying to just move on and forget about it all, to actually re-encounter some of those feelings and to allow the space for that within the cathedral. So I think there's some of that going on in that exhibition. One of my projects has also been establishing a workshop of liturgical arts in Chichester of artists creating beautiful art for God in worship, icons, mosaics. This is traditional iconography. And I would note that, you know, there's something about that traditional liturgical art, which is not just about provocation or expression, but it's also about allowing to be seen by God. We talk about icons, of course, being sort of windows into heaven. And that's a different sort of encounter in art, where actually you're allowed to be gazed upon in love. And it's interesting, we did commission a mosaic of St. Dominic, sort of tied to St. Richard. And it's remarkable each time you go into the cathedral in the evening and you see the kind of the gold illuminated by the lights in the corner of the cathedral, and in front of Dominic is just banks of candles where people have just gone to him. I don't think it's because there's a great devotion to St. Dominic in West Sussex necessarily, but there's something about the power of some of that traditional liturgical art, which helps people find healing. And that vision for art in worship, which is about establishing a new paradise in the context of the church, having a real vision for how all our liturgy, our music, our art, our architecture should, as people step into the cathedral, encounter something of paradise itself amidst the chaos of our world. And there's something about integration there going on, I think, when people encounter that.
I want to talk to you about, you know, that journey into the cathedral to find a bit of paradise. And cathedrals have often been destinations for pilgrimages. I know you've been looking at pilgrimages recently as well. Traditional healing journeys or journeys to God. Why are you interested in pilgrimage? Have you been on one? Are you a fan? Do you go on them all the time? Is there a favorite one that you can tell us about?
I wish I went on them more, because I love them every time I go on them. I think the first one I went on, actually, and still one of my favourite pilgrimages, was to St. David's I'm walking the Welsh coastline down from Fishguard. And I did that when I was a student. I was going with a parish group from Oxford, and it was remarkable, really. There were sort of hysterical moments too, moments of extraordinary coincidence. I remember us all sitting in the middle of nowhere singing this Italian Tese chant, as you do on these sorts of pilgrimages. And sort of out of nowhere appeared this Italian tourist, you know, what are you doing? And I think there's something about the various sort of strange and hysterical moments along that. So there's some lightness to pilgrimage, which even though it's tiring and exhausting, there's something about what you share along the way. It goes back to that point about solidarity and sharing space and time together with a particular goal in mind, which does a lot of work by itself. It's you know, I suppose it's Christ saying, "You take my yoke upon you," but there's something about that lightness and joy and freedom discovered together on pilgrimage, even when it's pouring with rain.
And why do you think they're light and joyful and free? You know, you're walking somewhere with a bag. You might not know where you're sleeping at night. You know, why are they such joyful things to do? Some might argue they're quite hard work.
So. Yeah, and of course, and they're sometimes extremely grisly and painful. But I suppose that's all part of the framing of the wider life, which is being brought to the pilgrimage. So, you know, it's remarkable how you encounter in Chichester people walking the old way to Canterbury, and Chichester is a place along that path. And Chichester was, of course, itself one of the great destinations for pilgrimage in the Middle Ages because of St. Richard's tomb. People coming to not specifically because they're religious, people have had messy divorces, trying to find healing, wanting to just get away from the phone and the demands of home. And I think the ups and downs of a pilgrimage, things going wrong, the pain, the bad weather, whatever, that helps you kind of make sense of the rest of the rubbish and crap in your life, I think. And something changes through that process in ways in which God speaks to you in the silence, in the walking, in the conversations.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's, I mean, in the olden days, as you can see, I'm definitely not a historian, but in ye olde times.
The olden England.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. People would go on pilgrimage as penance, so don't, you know, just wrong, or they'd go because they didn't have the NHS, they'd go and seek healing for a particular thing at a particular shrine, right? So in some ways, there's an understanding that pilgrimage is deeply religious. But there's been such a flourishing of pilgrimages. I think there's this program on the BBC of celebrities, I think, although I never know who they are, going on pilgrimages and seeing what happens, you know, and there's pilgrimage society. So it's kind of like sprung out. You know, we've got a, there's been a leak. Oh, everyone's discovered this.
Again, sort of tells you something about, not that pilgrimage is unique, of course, to Christianity, but it's interesting that with the decline in church going, that pilgrimage has almost become more important. There's still this desire to find sacred places. And you know, that's also part of the Instagram generation, isn't it? It's about experience, which actually provides enormous opportunity, I think, in pilgrimage. Mm. It's not just about knowledge. It's something about going through a ritual together and to a particular place which holds, because of relics, but also because of its historic importance, it's a place of destination. And I mean, the British Pilgrimage Trust has been immensely impressive in all that they've done. I mean, often that's sort of outside of the church, and kind of tapped into that desire or sort of parachurch activity, really. Perhaps more effectively than the church itself has done. I think the church has probably been much more, it's much more obsessed about people knowing and speaking about Jesus in a particular way, and perhaps lost some of those facilities for the more intangible and less concrete aspects of spirituality, which pilgrimage does provide for, and has kind of opened up a space in a country which, we'll get back to what I was saying earlier, is supposedly post-Christian, but still recognises these places as having a sacred significance. You know, and West Wales would be an example of that, wouldn't it? You know, people are just, it's got a sort of magnetic draw, and which keeps finding expression culturally in all sorts of different ways too. Think of, I've forgotten those beautiful islands just off the Welsh, at the Irish West Coast, which were used in Star Wars as an example of where Luke Skywalker has gone to kind of flee the chaos of the collapsing empire, kind of speaks to our own day, doesn't it? To try and, you know, where do we find places of congruence and making sense of ourselves in chaotic society too, that these places will become probably more important.
Yeah. And of course, this pilgrimage, I mean, by definition, is embodied. You've got to take your body.
Exactly.
So there's kind of connection in there. And
the incarnational and so re-establishing the bodily self, isn't it?
Yeah. And also in the land. I mean, I love going to the Outer Hebrides. And they've got the thing up there, but particularly, and they have it in Wales as well, along pilgrimage routes, they have holy wells. Places of the saints for refreshing people on the pilgrim ways. I dragged my kids around all the holy wells on the outer island. The guy, Alistair McIntosh, writes about them, and they're just like piles of wet stones. You've never seen more disappointed children. I'm getting very excited about slightly damp pebbles. But it connects you into the land in a way that
And the ecological, isn't it? I think there's something about reconnecting the body with the land. I think that's so important. Actually, I think that it's something which the Swedish Church, I know, and has done extremely well, has really tied into a new generation's desire to cherish and give thanks to God for the land, and recognizing its fragility and our damage to it. And there's something about treading softly across the land and reacquainting ourselves with it. This is certainly true.
Lovely. Dan, as we're sort of drawing to a close, I'm just reflecting back on our conversation. We've gone all sorts of different places as well. So, but listen, can we end? I'd just love to ask, what gives you hope? If we're looking at the connections between history in all sorts of different ways, and our present day flourishing as Christians, what gives you hope that the church can still be there and help people today to find flourishing in the complexity of their lives?
I think perhaps it goes back to it's the two images, really, I suppose, of seeing people as a presenter engaged with the Eucharist perhaps Good Friday is such a powerful thing in the cathedral, where in this barren space you've got this cross which people come and touch. And watching people do that, you see that there's still the power of the cross and the mystery of the resurrection to bring new possibilities out of the darkness and the seeming chaos of our lives and existence. And that's expressed as much in the building as it is in the liturgy itself. And I do see there is a sort of bubbling of desire, I think. You know, the more chaotic the world becomes, and the building bears testimony to this, the more significant that mystery becomes for people, and meaningful and transformative for their lives. And yeah, I suppose pointed to myself earlier on, you know, it's something which I sort of felt quite viscerally, all sorts of reasons, but it's one of the great joys of being a priest and being able to see that mystery come alive in others too. And something which I suppose as a priest, it's that's the particular privilege you have to encounter people at their deathbeds. Actually, as I'm just about to go off and administer the last rites to a wonderful person, and that I know will be one of the most hopeful things I do this day. because that,
wow.
You know, you're given something in that process, a sort of small insight into the mystery of the kingdom, in which we discover our strength in our weakness, God's strength in our weakness. And that, where do you see it more beautifully than a Christian who's giving themselves over to God at the end and letting go entirely into God's love?
Dan, thank you so much. You know, I just pray the God's with you as you go off from this podcast and be with that person.
Yeah, with your work too. Yeah, thank you.
What a thing to go and do. I thank God for you. I thank God for your ministry. Thank you for sharing with us on the podcast today. We are going to be picking up this conversation big time over in the Go Health community. And if you've been really encouraged or curious about what you've heard today, do have a look at our community. And we're on a journaling journey with our spiritual writer and friend, Wendy Lloyd, at the moment. And all new members can get a free journal to support them on their journey right now as we look at history and how it connects with our healing and flourishing. Thank you to Rosie Dawson, our producer, and for Wendy Lloyd from the Go Health team for all her work on this series and this podcast. Please do hit like and share to tell others about this episode and the work of the Go Health community, where together we seek to flourish and to be healing presences for all in the world today. Thank you once again, Dan.
Thank you.